Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting photojournalist Lindsay Addario, the Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer whose images depict life in locations ranging from Afghanistan to the Congo. We'll be discussing her new book, Of Love and War.
We'll also be discussing how to stay happy with author and journalist Helen Russell. She'll be talking through her book, The Atlas of Happiness, later in the show. And we'll hear from Finnish musicians Tuomo and Markus, whose tunes draw from not only their home country, but the wild expanse of Americana too. That's all to come in the next hour. Plus, Monocle's Bill Lutie will be here to look ahead to next week's news, and we'll enjoy more music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, here we are for the Monocle Weekly once again. Oh, I've been away actually for a week. Great to be back though in the hot seat alongside you. Here's a question, a bit little out of left field. What's your favourite kind of power?
My favourite kind of power is soft power, Tom.
Well, that is just extraordinary because this has been the week, of course, in which we published the 2018 Soft Power Survey. One of the things Monocle's most celebrated for, it's in the December-January double issue. It's not all been soft power. We've been hard at work, of course, crafting loads of great radio. One such miner at the coalface of news is a man we're going to hear from right now. It's Monocle's own Bill Lutie.
Which way you going, Billy? Can I go too?
Here he is, it's Bill Lutie. Bill, what will be setting the news agenda around the world in the week ahead?
Well, we're looking ahead to Wednesday and a 5-year anniversary of the Maidan uprising in Ukraine, which I think is really interesting. I've seen a couple of documentaries about it. It's kind of fascinating. There were huge protests, violence, clashes between the public and police, and occupation of the main square. Do you remember the images? It was kind of amazing, wasn't it?
It's extraordinary. And that is extraordinary. That's 5 years ago. It seems much more recent than that.
Yeah.
Which perhaps speaks volumes. The world has changed a lot since. These sorts of things are always quite pregnant with meaning. Are there going to be commemorations? How will this be marked, Bill? Because obviously it's still very politically sensitive.
Yeah, no, last weekend there were elections, weren't there? And then the UN came out and said the elections were illegal. Russia said they weren't illegal, they were fine. So there's so much tension there already. I've read articles about the Ukrainian government are trying to distance themselves from the Russian Orthodox Church. So there's kind of priests are being pressured into not teaching in Russian or giving those teachings specifically. So you'd think that they are going to just kind of let it blow over because you don't want to bring any extra tension into the country at the moment. But it kind of made me realise that's all still going on. 5 years later, there's still an annexation in Crimea. Nothing's really being done about it. I'm not really sure why it's just being overlooked.
Well, and earlier this week, you know, we covered on the Globalist, the inefficiency of sanctions on Russia. They're not doing anything. And it kind of begs the question of how the international community can respond to the ongoing Ukrainian conflict.
And Russia is still denying it anyway, so how can you be like, stop doing that thing? And they're like, we're not doing it anyway. What are you even talking about? It's hard to even like negotiate with that kind of, outlook, I guess.
Geopolitical gaslighting.
Certainly be interesting to watch then. And on Wednesday, we'll be keeping an eye. Mm. Where next?
Well, two more fun ones now. We're getting towards Christmas. So today, happy birthday is in order. Mickey Mouse! He's 90.
The big 9-0 for Mickey. Mm.
It's amazing, isn't it? Can you imagine? Tom, you probably remember 1928, Steamboat Willie first hit the screens. Can you remember it?
Very clear as day.
And it's like, I don't know, he's another one of those like amazing global brands, isn't he? So he's like Mario and I guess maybe some of the Pokemon, but not as much. But he is huge and you can kind of recognise the Mickey Mouse brand for Walt Disney, just everywhere. I'd probably say one of the most famous people on the planet.
Bill, I know this is tough and probably like that conversation your parents had about Santa. Mickey's not a person. He's a cartoon mouse and he's been through several iterations. Mm. I'd say he's a way bigger deal than a Pokemon from what I understand.
Yeah, what about Mario then?
And Mario.
Yeah?
Mickey Mouse.
Probably is,
He is out there on his own. As a cartoon character, I would say. And it's interesting to reflect because obviously this is a week, passing of Stan Lee, a comic creative genius. In some ways, it's hard to believe that some of these creations are, you know, that Mickey Mouse has not even been around for 100 years. seems crazy in a way.
So ingrained into our psyche.
It just seems... And you think back, even watching those early Steamboat Willie versions, which are obviously 90 years old this year, they in some ways seem older and in some ways they seem more contemporary.
Well, they fill you with a feeling of nostalgia, don't they?
A little bit.
One more?
Time for that.
Okay. Friday. It's Black Friday. I'm going to call it... I'm going to say it's named that because it's a dark and sorrowful day that marks the beginning of Christmas chaos.
This is this madcap, digital, free-for-all, horrible nonsense.
This is the one where you see, like, videos on YouTube
trampled.
Of, like, the doors of supermarkets opening and people getting punched in the face to get their hands on a TV marked down by about 40%.
Listen, at Monocle, we are strong supporters of bricks and mortar retail, but
not fighting
on Black Friday. I take exception to that. I guess if it is, it has a digital component, right? There's online deals.
Well, yes,
yeah, Cyber Monday. I think
you don't have to go. Oh, is it so? You don't basically on Friday you have to go and punch people in a.
Some people only go for the fighting.
Oh, for goodness sake! What a compelling few days ahead, Bill Lutie. Thanks for making sense of the madness for us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be talking to photojournalist Lindsay Addario.
American photojournalist Lindsay Addario's work has covered locations such as Iraq, Lebanon and the Congo and can regularly be seen in the pages of publications like the New York Times, National Geographic and Time magazine. It's earned her a Pulitzer Prize for international reporting back in 2009 for her coverage of the rise of the Taliban in Pakistan.
Her new book is Of Love and War, over 200 images from across the Middle East, South Asia and Africa, profiling two decades of photography, along with letters and essays as well. And Lindsay joins us now, I'm delighted to say, to tell us more. I sort of glibly said, oh, you know, what a beautiful book, and congratulated you as we came to the studio. And it is beautiful, but it contains obviously images which followers of your work will know are very challenging. I don't know, is there almost a paradox about making a beautiful volume of pictures that are covering the work for which you're most well known?
I struggle with that question all the time. You know, I think for me as a photojournalist covering these really devastating, difficult moments around the world, often in war, at the height of war, sometimes in the aftermath, I'm always trying to figure out, how do I bring in the viewer? How do I make someone engage with a photograph and really enter it? And that is difficult to do when the photo is graphic or bloody or too violent, because I think most people's instinct is to turn away. So for me, it's really about, how can I capture that devastation in a more subtle way, or sometimes in a beautiful way, because people can stop and look at an image and then realize what's actually happening.
This is something I wanted to ask about, because obviously we're now entering this sort of much touted age of the citizen journalist, and the image has also undergone this often spoken about democratization. People are sharing videos and images from terrible places on Twitter. It's very easy to find this sort of thing. How does that not compromise what you're setting out to do?
Well, actually, I think it makes my work all the more important, because, first of all, people on social media have to realize and be very aware of where they get their news sources and where they are looking at the images from, because you need to trust that the photographer or journalist or whoever is behind the lens is not biased, that you're actually, the caption is correct, the information underneath the photograph, you know, what photographers call the caption, but really the information that accompanies the photograph is accurate, because falsehoods spread like wildfire on social media. And so it's very important for people to understand where the images are coming from. We also are inundated with images all the time. And so I've always believed sort of the best images will rise to the top, that professional photographers know how to take that image, or we strive to take that image that encapsulates not only information, but beautiful light and composition and all the things that do get people to pay attention.
Do you find that you're having to justify your credentials in a different way with a certain audience who say, well, hang on, how do I know, Lindsay, that you're portraying the truth of the situation to me?
Ironically, it has nothing to do with social media. It has everything to do with the political climate in which we're living. You know, I think I am an American journalist. I've spent most of my career working for The New York Times and National Geographic and Time, and those are all publications that are very reputable. There is very extensive fact-checking that goes on. So when I shoot a story, for example, for National Geographic, they spend weeks fact-checking every single image and contacting the people in the photographs. And so it's not fake news. But we do live in a climate now where we have a president who says very often that journalists are the enemy of the people. He does use the term fake news a lot. He does get the attention of his supporters. And so that is a big problem for journalists, not only in America, but around the world, because people are skeptical now of journalists in a way they weren't so much before. We also are in a climate where journalists are targeted more than before around the world. We look at the killing of Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist. That is astonishing that it, you know, there hasn't been full-on condemnation by the American government yet. Because I think the fact is, with the rhetoric that journalists are the enemy of the people, it does give governments license to think that they can kill journalists with impunity. For me, when I started covering, for example, the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan or the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, I was proud to be a journalist and an American journalist, and we drove around with the words TV on our cars and put journalist on our flak jackets. And that's something that we would never, ever do now, because journalists are getting kidnapped. Of course, they're getting killed. They're disappearing. Prominent journalists, too. I mean, it's not just sort of, not that it makes a difference because any journalist is a journalist doing a service, but it's pretty unbelievable when very high-profile journalists suddenly go missing or are killed, and it's not condemned worldwide.
That makes me think of Marie Colvin, who was targeted by the Syrian authorities. In the past, maybe young journalists would have gone to cover conflicts, and now, certainly in the UK, major newspapers aren't accepting freelance pitches from anyone who's there because they want to deter people from going. If there's this elevated level of risk, how are we going to, beyond Twitter reportage, beyond citizen journalism, how are we going to guarantee our coverage from these zones, you know, in the future? How are we going to give people there a voice?
So look, I mean, there are still very seasoned journalists working in these places, you know, and there will always be new journalists who want to come in and cut their teeth on some war. I think what many of the editors and many of the more seasoned journalists are saying, like, don't go to Syria to learn how to be a war correspondent. You know, you can work your way up. There are, you know, there are wars where the sort of hostility is not all focused on the Western journalists. You know, that is a case like in Syria where it's very dangerous to be a Western journalist. You know, there's ISIS operating, Al-Qaeda. There are all sorts of jihadi groups that have said, you know, obviously have made it clear that it's more dangerous for Western journalists. I think we do, you know, news organizations do reprint and use the work of citizen journalists in the absence of any other people being on the ground. I mean, if you look at, for example, Yemen. Yemen is a war. I was just in Yemen for 2 weeks in September for the New York Times Magazine. It's a war that is grossly undercovered because it's almost impossible to get in. And it's also very dangerous. You know, the Saudis and the coalition have literally cut off the airspace so journalists can't fly into Sana'a to cover northern Yemen. You have to fly into Aden and make this very treacherous drive all the way north, which is almost 12 hours, making it very difficult and very dangerous for journalists to cover that. So we have relied on whatever comes out, whether it's from the UN or aid workers or whatever information we can get out of there. So, you know, I think there's a compromise. If there's nothing else coming out of there, I think editors do consider who's on the ground, but we have to put a disclaimer. You know, this is not a trained journalist. It's not a staff journalist. We're not positive how this image was taken.
Lindsay, let's talk a little bit more about of Love and War. And one thing I wanted to get you to reflect on for us, if you can, is the process almost of putting together a piece like this, because obviously it's very different than a regular assignment, and your sort of curatorial eye has been trained over Well, I think you're right, probably millions of images. How did that start? Did you have quite a clear vision for what you wanted to include, how you'd tell the tale, or did you? Was it sort of learn by doing?
It was very, very difficult. First of all, I didn't really have a vision. I sort of thought, okay, well, I've been photographing for 23 years. I've never done a solo book of photography. I've sort of given bodies of work to certain compilations of photography, but I haven't done a solo body. And so it was a bit overwhelming, the whole process. You know, over the years, I've sort of pulled photographs and bodies of work that have resonated with me over time that I always kind of refer to when I do public speaking. Those are the bodies of work I show. So those were kind of the spine of the book that I felt like would be in there. You know, Darfur, the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, the Korangal Valley. They're all bodies of work that are in there. But then there are other bodies of work, like the drought in the Horn of Africa in 2011, that is a very special body of work to me, that fell out, that didn't make the cut. So basically how I went about it was I pulled together, you know, thousands and thousands of images. And I got the name of Stuart Smith, who's a book designer actually in London, and he's done many, many books. And I went to meet with him, and we hit it off right away. And Claudia, who works with him, also, you know, I saw the books they'd done, and I respected their style. And I basically just dumped my archive on them and was like, have fun, you know, let me know when you come up with an edit. I've always been of the philosophy that I'm not the best editor of my own work. I kind of know images that I really love, but I was curious sort of, I liked the process of handing over that archive to them to see what stuck with them, you know, with a completely fresh eye. And basically, over the course of a year, I went back to Stu's studio and met with him and Claudia and really sort of just kept sort of, pictures would fall out. I mean, they literally made small prints of thousands of images, and we went through them. Yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And then after about a year, we kind of got to the point where there were solid bodies of work. And then it was the question of, how do we put them together? You know, how do we do the flow of a book like this? You know, do we do it chronologically? Do we do it by theme, you know, women's issues, or do we do it by country? So then I really sort of deferred to Stuart and, you know, what he thought about that process. And again, we went back and forth a lot. And I knew I wanted to include some journals and some writing in there because to me, you know, a book of photography is it's a tough process for me because, you know, I like the words that go alongside photographs and I like the thought process and I like sort of the rawness of these journals that I was really young and I wasn't a very good photographer and I didn't know where I wanted to go as a photographer. And I think that helps the sort of narrative arc of the images.
I mean, the cover image, for example, absolutely incredible image. Maybe you could tell us the tale of that one specifically, perhaps.
Sure. So that particular image was in 2004, in August. It was my first trip ever to Africa. And I was going into Darfur. So we flew into Chad. And in order to get into Northwest Darfur at that time, we had to walk through rivers and walk through the desert for about 2 kilometers, so maybe like a mile, maybe more than a mile. And we linked up with these rebels. And there were, I don't know, at least probably about 15 rebels on the back of one pickup truck. And so then we were 4 journalists in total. And you can imagine how laden that pickup truck was because it was not only us, but everything that they carried along with them to fight a war. And so we rode around on the back of that truck for about 5 days. And on the way into Darfur, the truck broke down like every 45 minutes or so because we were driving clear across the desert. I mean, there was no paved road. I mean, we're literally just careening through, you know, the desert. So this is one of those moments where the truck broke down, a sandstorm was coming in the background, and I was photographing this soldier. And it's a man. It's not a woman. Everyone thinks that this is a woman, but it's a man.
I'm interested in knowing what your metrics are for a successful image, for an image that you love. Is it about the context in which it was made, or is it about the composition of it, or is it about the impact it went on to have?
So it's funny. Actually, I feel the opposite. Most of my images I hate. Most of my images I can't stand to look at because all I can think about is I should have shot that differently, you know, and I missed this or I missed that. And so the images in this book are sort of the ones I can bear, you know, I could actually deal with looking at. You know, for me, a good photograph, a good conflict photograph, really gives you sort of a visceral reaction. You know, you look at it and you feel the tension of the moment, or you feel the stress and the fear of the moment. And so, you know, it also can have a different effect where suddenly you look at it and you don't realize what it is. And it looks sort of, you know, beautiful, kind of like the cover of the book. No one realizes that it's a fighter, you know, that it's a Sudanese Liberation Army rebel, you know. And so I think there are two ways a conflict photograph can go. You know, it's either that classic war image that really speaks to sort of the violence and tension and fear of war and the trauma of war, or it's more subtle and it's quite sort of quiet and beautiful.
Of Love and War is an absolutely astonishing achievement. Congratulations again, and people can find information of where to buy copies and all the rest.
Thank you.
What's next? Is it the sort of, are you continuing jetting around? Have you got something you really want to do in the next few months? Maybe some long-held ambitions to realise?
You know, I literally just came back a Sunday from about 3 months on the road. So I was in Yemen and northern Nigeria photographing women giving birth in Boko Haram territory. So that was a very intense story. And then I've been on book tour in America. So I think for now, through the holidays, I'll sort of roughly be around. I have two stories I've been working on that I have to wrap up. So I have to make one trip to southern Italy for Time magazine and go to Belgium for the New York Times for a very long-term story that I'm hoping will run early next year. So yeah, I'll do a little work, but I'll mostly be around for now. And I think, you know, in the future, of course, I'll keep doing this work. I always sort of listen to my instinct of what stories, what subjects speak to me at different points in my life. I think America is a fascinating place right now and a very important place to be working as a journalist.
It's wonderful to hear that, and it's wonderful to hear from you. Thanks for going to see us again.
Thanks so much.
This is the weekly Music Time Now. We'll be hearing from Finnish duo Tuomo and Marcus later. Here's one of their tracks right now. It's called Over the Rooftops. That was Tuomo and Marcus with Over the Rooftops. They'll be speaking to us at the end of the programme. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Author and journalist Helen Russell has been looking around the world at locations that seem a little happier than others for her new book, The Atlas of Happiness.
She's been studying places ranging from Iceland, where the concept of theta redast, the unwavering belief that everything will work out in the end, holds sway, to Bhutan, where GNH, gross national happiness, is a guideline for ensuring well-being is prioritised ahead of financial gain.
Earlier, she spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about the new book. He began by asking about Denmark, a nation who regularly tops happiness polls, and Helen's earlier book, The Year of Living Danishly.
I moved to Denmark in 2013. My husband got a job at Lego, and I started to investigate happiness in Denmark, then one of the happiest countries in the world. And so The Year of Living Danishly really sparked off these conversations. It was published in 20 countries worldwide, and people from all over the world started sharing with me their own country's unique happiness secrets. And I came to learn, just as you said, that it's not just the countries that we might associate with happiness, but there are also countries that never come top of these polls, who have some really interesting ways to be happy and find meaning in life. So I wanted to really dig into those as well. So that's what spurred it on.
And let's be honest, Helen, I mean, I know it's a bit of a cliche to say this, but we are living quite a difficult times politically. I mean, it can be quite sad in a way. So it's quite interesting to see how people are still kind of celebrating happiness. Do you think this affects people's mood as well?
Of course, and certainly it does. But my standpoint is that optimism is not frivolous, it's necessary. And yes, in these days with rolling news and with social media, it's easy to get the idea that bad is all there is, but that's negativity bias. So we have to work to overcome that, to really appreciate that there are good things happening. And it doesn't mean burying our heads in the sand. It just means restoring our empathy and compassion, our humanity, so that we're able to get out there and make a difference. So that was the why it felt really important to me right now, because as you say, these are tough times.
We will look at some of the examples later, but do you think countries in general, I presume perhaps Denmark does that, even their governments, they do actually include happiness in their plans, you know, in how to govern. Do you think this is happening more and more countries as well?
Yeah, I mean, certainly Ban Ki-moon worked with Bhutan after 2011 to really look at how to integrate happiness into government policy. So it is certainly something people are starting to think about more, but to a greater or lesser extent. I think there's still a long way to go.
And, you know, and I want to go personal. You were a Brit living in Denmark as well. Do you mix? Because, you know, there's a chapter about England here, the jolly way. Do you mix a little bit with the Danish way of happiness as well?
I think I do. I've had to get much better at the Danish work-life balance. This arbeidsglød from arbeider to work and glød, the word for happiness. I think coming from London, I worked for 12 years in London on a glossy magazine. I had to get much better at logging off guilt-free and stopping work in a way that I really hadn't been used to working long hours in London. So I try to do that now. And I also, I guess I always bring the Brit in me as well. So the English jolliness I try to bring with me to my everyday life too.
And I was very interested actually about the English chapter because, you know, I came from Brazil 10 years ago. And it's interesting, even though I now enjoy this idea of let's have tea and biscuits and, you know, everything will be fine. But for example, your use of satire, because for Brazilians, it's completely different in a way. We kind of get scared with satire in a way.
That's true. It can be quite cutting. Yeah, I spoke to some Americans this morning who said, "What the British sense of humour? I mean, what is that? Are you being horrible to each other?" No, that's our way of showing love. And I talk about in the book that this idea that even when terrible things happen, I think perhaps the American and many other cultures' response is to go quite syrupy and go in there with love and it's, oh, we are there for you. And the English typical response is to make light of it and to keep calm and carry on. And yeah, as you say, put the kettle on, have some cake. And it's a coping mechanism of sorts. It may not be the most psychologically healthy, but it has worked for some time.
Oh, let's be honest, I'm from Brazil. I'm not sure if our method is that healthy as well, because we're quite nostalgic people as well. It's fascinating. There's a chapter here called saudade, which is the feeling of longingness, right?
But I love that. I think that's so interesting. Having studied happiness personally and professionally for decades now, the idea that it's okay not to be okay. Psychologists agree that there's a real merit to this way of thinking. Life is not one long unicorn skipping with rainbows. We will all encounter some suffering and we have to be able to cope with that. And that's something that we're not taught growing up, certainly not in the UK. So I think the Brazilian approach, psychologists have found that by experiencing this temporary sadness, it helps us to be more resilient long term. It helps us to have more empathy, even be more generous. So I think that's something we can certainly learn from. Please teach your new colleagues about that.
I will teach them to be a little bit more nostalgic in a way. I mean, that's a kind of a difficult question, but do you think, are there better approaches, or do you think every country has its, you know, as you mentioned, Brazil, England, you know, it's fair enough. That's how they deal. Or do you think there's a better way?
I think some of the concepts do appear to contradict others. And that's kind of okay. I feel like now we're all different. That's okay. You take what works for you. I didn't want to. That's one of the reasons that I went in alphabetical order, because I didn't want to make a sort of hierarchy of this country wins, this country comes bottom. There are pros and cons. So I like to think of it as like bibliotherapy. You pick what works for you. So there's something to be said for most places. And the ones that I've focused on, I feel there are things that we can learn from.
What was the most surprising for you, perhaps?
Oh, well, I started writing this book when I had just come back from maternity leave, having had twins. And I'd been on bed rest. I'd been in wheelchairs for a lot of the pregnancy. And it was a strange time, identity-wise, reconciling this idea we all have of ourselves in our heads with the person I saw in the mirror. And I got to go to Japan, to Tokyo, for the launch of my first book there, and really dug into how people were trying to stay happy in a country that we don't normally associate with happiness in Japan. And actually wabi-sabi, this idea of the beauty of imperfection and the texture and reality of everyday life, was incredibly helpful. This idea that we shouldn't all be trying to look young all the time, or that we shouldn't be trying to conceal our scars. There is a beauty in aging and a beauty in simplicity, and no one should try to be perfect anymore. That was really helpful personally at that time in my life, as I was sort of wafting around like a sort of ghost of my former self. So yeah, that helped me a lot.
Another curious country was Switzerland, the federalism in a way. That's fascinating because it is true. I mean, he's a national hero, and at the same time that he's perfect in what he does, but he's quite humble in a way. He doesn't brag.
Absolutely. So the idea is that Switzerland always comes top of these happiness polls, but nobody is quite sure why, least of all the Swiss. So when I interviewed lots of people in Switzerland, they all sort of pointed to meticulousness or not being flashy about their wealth or having quite a good outdoorsy life. And fans of Roger Federer will describe their approach to life as Federerism. So I co-opted this for looking at why the Swiss are so happy. And yeah, you're right. They're very cool. They don't show off. Bragging is frowned on. There is a humbleness. They work really hard. They plan, crucially. And Roger Federer, yeah, he is just this really cool guy. I spoke to a sound recordist who'd just done a job with him. He said, oh my goodness, he charmed everyone in the room. He shook hands, he made eye contact, he smelled fantastic. And you think, yeah, there is something that's just perfect about him.
And
yeah,
he doesn't even need to brag.
Maybe doesn't that's even why. Need to brag,
maybe
yeah,
that's why, because it's all perfection.
Yeah.
And interesting, I mean, let's talk about Denmark again. That's the country you live. In a way, they managed to sell this image of happiness, and it's been working very well for Dan in a way. Like, even when I say to my friends, oh, I've been to Copenhagen, everybody has this image of an idyllic city. I mean, it is a wonderful city, but do you think countries can sell themselves by the way they celebrate happiness as well, or having this, let's say, jolly image?
That's a great question. I mean, I certainly didn't write this as a PR exercise. This is not I'm not being funded by any tourist boards. I think it's more indicative of the people there. But I think there is certainly something about Copenhagen in particular, as you mentioned it, that is quite special. It's a capital city, but it's also quite relaxed. There's more equality than you see elsewhere. There's not such extremes as you see in some places. So I think, yeah, probably just as a capital city is never indicative of a whole country, but you probably can get a taste, get a flavour as you travel around to places by thinking about their approach to happiness and really what makes people tick.
I love how they explore the concept of hygge, and a lot of other countries are trying to go and, you know, say, oh, no, but here in Wales we have this, and in Scotland we have that as well. So that's quite fun. It's creating like a dispute about
a fun
happiness.
Rivalry,
exactly.
Yeah.
That's a good rivalry, right?
Well, I was really interested speaking to many Germans for the research, and Gemütlichkeit that they have has some similarities to hygge, but for them, crucially, they wouldn't like to talk about it all the time, whereas the Danes love to talk about it. And in Germany, it can be more of a private thing. It's not necessarily to do with friends and family. It's just something that has to be earned. You see the Protestant work ethic, and it was fascinating digging into the histories of each of the countries and seeing how that plays into ideas of happiness. So Martin Luther banishing the Catholic ideals and the way that the church had been running, he really started, of course, the Protestant the Reformation, and this still plays into, even today, ideas about what it is to live a good life in Germany. So it's fascinating from a cultural perspective to see how these vary between countries.
And Helen, again, congratulations on the book. It looks beautiful as well. So it's a kind of book that makes you happy, in a way.
I think so.
Do you know
yeah.
what I mean? It's lovely illustrations. And at the end of each chapter, they have how to adopt, you know, a certain process. For example, I have here Thailand, how to adopt a Mai Pen Rai approach to life as well. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Helen Russell there, discussing the Atlas of Happiness with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Finnish musician Tuomo will be familiar to Monocle 24 listeners. His combination sound of soul, jazz and pop has graced our airwaves many a time. But he's also been working with fellow Finn Markus Nordenstreng on a project over the past few years incorporating the sounds of classic Americana. The duo's album, Dead Circles, was recorded in Tucson, Arizona, and featured appearances from members of US acts ranging from Wilco to Calexico and the Jayhawks. Tuomo and Markus were in London for some shows earlier this week, and Monocle's Tom Hall caught up with them to learn more.
You gotta burn your castle down.
My band called The Late Birds were approached by these expats living in America who organize there's a Finnish community all over the states, and they organize these festivals once a year. Yeah, and it's in different parts of the country. So the idea is that all these expats get together and then, like, pretend they're in Finland for a weekend or something. So there's, like, Finnish culture, Finnish food, etc. So my band at the time got approached to play there, and then it so happened that our bass player's wife was pregnant, and she was due the same week when we were supposed to play there. So our band couldn't make it, and then I just suggested, well, I have my friend Tuomo, why don't we come there as a duo? Because I'd never been to Tucson, I'd never been to Arizona, and neither had Tuomo. So we thought that it'd be a nice excuse to visit Arizona. And we went there, and you know, the festival, which is called FinFest, that only lasts for a couple of days. So we were there for a full week. So after seeing the Desert Museum, which was really cool, we thought, well, we'd like to do stuff, you know, and be creative. So we went to the studio, which is in downtown Tucson, called Wave Lab, which is where the band Calexico works. And we just went there kind of without, you know, much pre-planning, and started cutting songs that didn't really fit into anything that we were doing at the time, like neither my band nor what Tuomo was doing. And the material was so good that, you know, it just became a new project. And then here we are, like, 5 years later, you know.
And Tuomo, tell me about some of the personnel on the record, because you've got people like John Stirrett and Pat Sansone from Wilco, and as Marcus was mentioning, Calexico on there as well. Yeah. How did you pull those people in? How did they pop up on this record?
Well, yeah, that has mostly to do with, like, the Wilco guys are people that Marcus has been familiar with for years, and he knows from there. And of course, like, when we were in Tucson, we actually went, after the first session we did there, we went back a year or so later and did another session, and we invited, because we knew some of the Calexico people live in Tucson. So we just called them up and, you know, asked them to be on the record. And since they're good friends with the owners of the studio, they came up. And also Gary Loris of the Jayhawks, Marcus actually wrote one of the songs with him. So he naturally...
The opening song.
Yeah.
So, with the rooftops. Yeah.
So we asked him to do some backing vocals for us.
I'm curious, Marcus, have you been reading any of the Jeff Tweedy book that's coming
out?
Not
yet.
Yeah,
I'm interested, definitely.
Yeah, it's funny that this chat sort of came up because I've been reading that book, and he has some quite, I don't know, surprising views, I thought, on the concept of what Americana is, because he apparently, when Wilco first came out, he said he wanted them to be known as anything but Americana, because he hates being sort of boxed in that sort of rootsy sound. And you guys are obviously doing something different with it as well. I mean, as we mentioned, you're not from that part of the world, but you're borrowing those influences. I mean, do you kind of enjoy hearing people say, oh, that sounds Americana, or that sounds country, or that sounds Laurel Canyon, or are you preferring to kind of let it just grow into its own thing?
Well, I think whenever you're compressed to a format, that's artistically can be pretty frustrating. So I can relate to what Jeff Tweedy thinks. I think, like, since we made that record, we've progressed even more. We've kind of gone way beyond Americana. Like, what we do live, there's a whole big jazz element, because Tuomo has this incredible capability playing jazz piano, better than hardly anybody in Finland. And we also have a really amazing trumpet player named Verneri Pohjola, who's actually a pretty established jazz trumpet player and an artist in the UK as well. So he plays trumpet with us. So we kind of go way beyond, as does Wilco. I mean, that they sometimes do country songs and, I guess, stuff that would be categorized as being within the Americana tag, but a lot of the time they go way beyond. I mean, even to, like, avant-garde and way beyond. And that's kind of, I guess, what we aim to do. And it kind of comes naturally. Like, I don't know. I never-
never understood philosophy, but I love philosophers. Love logicians, mad mathematicians, looking for logic in a chaotic world. But I know one question will never be answered if you search till the day you die. And then if 5-year-old knows what it is, the question ain't what, it's why.
When we first started making music together, it was kind of, there was this, you know, we come from different backgrounds musically. I'm from jazz and soul, and Marcus has more of a rock and roll and country and all that, like, but there's a huge, like, middle ground of stuff that we both love, you know, and it crosses over a lot. And we just sort of, I guess it was a natural thing to leave out the, like, modern R&B stuff that I like to do, and also maybe the more, like, rock and roll-y stuff that Marcus does, and, you know, take all the other stuff that's left and, you know, just combine that. But yeah, definitely, like, lately we've been trying to expand it even more, you know, especially with the sort of jazz and even, like, slight influences from classical music that I'm really been into in the last few years. So, you know, expand the sound a little bit more.
I mean, like, I grew up listening to, you know, a lot of American rock and roll, also like punk rock. I mean, I love the Ramones and Replacements and all that stuff, but I don't know if Tuomas even ever heard the Replacements. I should probably play you some Replacements.
Yeah, true.
But and Television, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Bands like the Replacements, they did sort of span quite a really big kind of angle, I guess, because it could be this, like, absolutely shambolic sort, yeah, of aggressive punk thing, and then a minute later they'd be doing these really soft, sort of sensitive ballads.
Yeah, I mean, that was the Big Star influence, and you know, there was always that sensitive side. I mean, that was always the side of Paul Westerberg that I was drawn to, was the, I guess, the more sensitive element. But I also loved when they were kind of going all over the place. I got to see them actually on the tour that they, when they kind of reunited.
I saw as well, and he had a letter on his shirt for, yeah, every show, and then at the end of the tour people worked out that it, I can't remember what it said, but it said like something like never again or that. I've sold myself out, or
yeah,
something.
It was in relation to Ray Davies, I think,
right,
like to a stunt that Ray Davies did. And that's another, I mean, like Ray Davies and the Kinks, and then I was a huge Stones fan. You know, I mean, and still am. And then, of course, you know, the usual, the Beatles and all the solo projects. I mean, that's kind of like, that was my breeding ground. As well as then all these guitar players. I mean, I loved a lot of blues stuff. And Ry Cooder was kind of predominantly the reason why I got into, like, the, you know, plugged into the great Americana amp, if you like, because that was like way beyond just a small country format. Or, I mean, he was kind of doing Americana before anything was labeled as Americana. He was really, I think, a pioneer in that.
Yeah, taking it like whatever's good and mixing it up and doing his own.
Yeah, I mean, Cuban music and Hawaiian stuff. And then, like, I really loved the record he did in Ireland quite recently, which was then like Irish music, and I mean, he's an amazing guy.
So this project, it's not strictly bound to the Tucson postcode. You feel like you could take it anywhere.
Yeah, definitely. And we actually, like, well, the new stuff that we're working on, there's a song that's about Galway that has a strong Irish influence to it, and we also, like, we're well aware of the fact that being Finnish, like, when we go to the States and play, that's going to be the part that interests the people, like, the part of our music that doesn't sound American, you know, like, so even though we've always, I think we've both grown up listening to mostly, like, American and UK music as well, but whenever we find something there that this has a sort of maybe Nordic feel to it. You know, we just
Nordic kind of, manic depressive.
Yeah, we try to embrace it because, you know, that's going to be what sets us apart.
But that's very much shared in country as well, manic depression. That's true. Basically what it's all about. Let's talk about Finnish music as well for a minute, because you come in with laden with gifts, and you instantly handed me your album, which is on this beautiful vinyl, but you also handed me this, I don't know what you would call it, a side project maybe, Pratt and Moody, which is also yourselves, but you're talking about the record label that it's on and stuff. And tell me a little bit about what that project is and the record label that's on.
Well, that was kind of a happy accident. There's a label in Finland called Timian Records, and they also cut vinyl. It's really they are kind of the only entity in Finland that cuts vinyl, you know, masters vinyl. And then once you've cut vinyl, you send it to the plant, and then you get the finished product. Well, some people just send the masters immediately to the plant and then have just some guy at the plant do the job, and you don't even get any refs or anything. But we really wanted to make sure that it sounds great, because we only put the record out on vinyl. There is a CD inside. You can get it with a CD, but, you know, we thought that this is vinyl music. We really want it to sound great. And then it's in Spotify as well. But so that was the idea. So we worked with this guy, and then he really loved our vocal blend. And he said, you know, it'd be nice to do something together. But I couldn't really understand what he was going on about, because what Timian Records does is, like, it sounds really nothing like our record, at least in my ears at the time, I thought, because it's sort of like, what would be the right...
Well, like garage soul, you know, like it's very retro 60s sounding.
Yeah, I guess they would be like the Finnish equivalent of Daptone, like what they do, and you know, the Daptone. Daptones.
Quite raucous, soul-infused rock and roll, really.
Yeah, and very much like the soul, like a retro soul element to it. So we went in the studio with those guys, and then we recorded a track, and then those guys kind of did something with the track, and then it became like a whole different, a new song. Originally, we went there to cut one of Tuomo's songs that we'd played previously, and then these guys kind of destroyed it, but made it into something really cool, which is what is then on that record. And it's called Lost, Lost, Lost. I don't know how to, like, explain what that music is, because there's definitely its soul, and it's kind of, there's like a retro element to it, but at the same time it's kind of modern. I thought it was a really cool thing that we've made another single since, but that's like the first one we did together.
I had a question actually, when because basically I was reading through some of the material and some of the reviews, and people were sort of making the references that people will always make, you know, like, oh, it's got a bit of Crosby, Stills and Nash and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I started to, it was interesting you mentioned your vocals sort of intertwining in that way. And I started to wonder, like, is it time that we stopped kind of just making these really, really, really obvious, like, first generation rock and roll references to describe things? Because it's like, this is a Tuomo and Marcus blending of voices, you know? It's like, maybe one day we should be saying it's a bit Tuomo and Marcus rather than Crosby, Stills and Nash.
Or Simon and Garfunkel.
It's not like they own the license to have, like, close vocal harmonies. I mean, do you get kind of, like, a little bit fed up with people making fairly obvious references for very sort of human qualities in music?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's a handy tool when you're describing something to someone who hasn't heard it, you know? So I totally get that. People, when, you know, describing music, will reference it with something else. But of course, you know, it gets boring after all. Well, we're mostly been getting Simon and Garfunkel, and that has only, I think, to do with a couple of songs that are, well, very obviously we took influences from Simon and Garfunkel there, you know.
Not necessarily even directly. It might have been through somebody else. I mean, like, I was a huge Elliott Smith fan, and I kind of still carry that with me. And, you know, he was obviously, he never actually said it out that he appreciated Simon and Garfunkel, but I think you can hear it. I mean, Simon and Garfunkel and the Beatles and Big Star were Elliott Smith's big, those are the,
yeah,
you know,
I was going to say, in Elliott Smith, I can definitely hear that sort of like high-pitched John Lennon thing going on. Yeah. As well. You've got a John Lennon cover on this record, is that right? What made you pick that one? And were you sort of looking for covers, or did it just seep in there?
Well, it just so happened that I became a father around the same time when we started working on the record. And I mean, that didn't influence only our choice of a Lennon cover, which is A Beautiful Boy, which John Lennon wrote for, you know, Sean Lennon. And, you know, I was expecting a baby boy as well. So we actually played that one live before my son was born. But then it just seemed like something we could record. And I think there's a bit of a jazzy take on it, even more so now when we play live. So it's, I mean, doing John Lennon covers or Bob Dylan covers, which is another cover we do on the record, in order to kind of do those songs, I think you have to have a different take on it. Like, if especially Lay Lady Lay, which we did on the record, that Tuomo sings, it's a whole different arrangement. Even more so than I think my version of
We've always been doing cover songs though. Like when we started playing together, like as a duo first, the whole thing was we wanted to try out, because before we went into the studio, we did a few gigs here and there, and it was just like we were trying out our new songs. You know, Marcus has something, and I have some new songs that I want to just, you know, just play them for an audience and try how they feel. But then of course we, you know, if we played like two sets, we would let's do some covers as well, you know, find some cool songs that we like, you know. And so we've always played covers, and those were just two cover songs that we figured, like, we have actually like a really nice arrangement of these, and why not put them on the record as well.
You've got some shows coming up before the end of the year. Tell people where people can come and catch you live.
Well, we're playing in Finland in a couple of weeks, but then we're playing a special show actually in Prince's hometown, Minneapolis. We're playing, opening for the Jayhawks in Minneapolis, which is in like just before Christmas. And then every New Year's we do this special show in Tampere, which is not even our hometown, about 2 hours from Helsinki. So we do that every New Year's. And then early next year we're off to the States. We're doing Winter Jazz Fest in New York, and we're doing some shows on the East Coast, and I think in the Midwest as well. Yeah, I think that's kind of the plan. Well, I'm sure we'll get back to the UK as well, hopefully in the spring sometime.
Well, I wish you all the best with it. Tuomo and Marcus, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Tuomo and Marcus there, speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. Catch them live in December, both in Hämeenlinna, Finland on the 1st and at First Avenue, Minneapolis on the 21st. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Well, there you have it, Augustin Macellari. That is edition 489 of The Monocle Weekly. What a joy. I always say each time we do the show, you feel like you learned something, you feel like you've gone on a little journey together. And one thing that has been reconfirmed to me is how excellent Lindsay Addario is. Not only for her brilliant and beautiful new book of Love and War, but just generally a thoroughly good egg. Fascinating. I could listen to Lindsay all day.
Yeah, she was very interesting. Her ruminations on the future of journalism were kind of heartening, I guess. It's interesting to know that editors are starting to look at citizen journalism as a kind of more, you know, reasonable resource than it has been, just because journalists are finding it so difficult to get in.
Right, that's it. Let's thank our friends behind the glass. The programme was produced by Tom Hall and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. My thanks to them all. We'll be back at the same time next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Augustin Macellari.
Goodbye.
Bye.